Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Dukmasova, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time of the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Wednesday, March 6, 2024. And here's a story that broke today, which is actually germane, very germane to what we're about to discuss. Usually, you know, I just... typical Ben Jarofsky. I just... no connection whatsoever in this universe. Man, I wouldn't last 2 seconds in BEZ. What are you doing? Everything has to be connected and unified. But this one actually connects to what we're going to discuss. I'll tell you what, this dude who I'm about to quote is a very funny man in a very dark way, and should be making dark Coen brother-like movies. Here we go. And here is what I will quote. It is about the outcome, I guess, of Super Tuesday, which was yesterday. Quote, "So here we are, trapped for 8 more long months in a nightmare election between 2 radioactive old men who could only possibly beat each other. A generic Republican would crush Biden and a generic Democrat would crush Trump. Instead, the party's voters and elites have somehow managed to steer these two unwieldy Titanics on a direct collision course with one another and have asked us all to politely stay down in steerage and enjoy the carnage. Don't be surprised if many people refuse to comply." That assessment of where we are right now belongs to the man who I will now ask to introduce himself, and then away we go. Distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Well, Ben, it's great to be back. I'm Mr. Sunshine, David Ferris, Associate Professor of Political Science, Roosevelt University.
I know you're not a Bulls fan, man. But there's I find him very entertaining in a dark way. The guy who covers the Bulls for the Chicago Sun-Times is named Joe Colley. And I teasingly call him Mr. Sunshine all the time because he's so dark. No matter what the Bulls do, he flips it. So it's bad. And I just, in a perverse kind of way, it's entertaining. You know what I mean? Because they are utterly mediocre. But so when you said Mr. Sunshine, I thought of my Joe Colley. And so, all right, and this same column, which you wrote for Newsweek, David, also writes for Newsweek and Slate, begins with, "Well, that was perfectly pointless, a great lead, a great summary of the first portion of this very bizarre system we have electing presidents, which is, of course, the primary system. Then when it's over, which is usually around March or April, we just like sit around for, I don't know what, how many months that is, 5 months, as these two candidates just sort of travel across the country and no one pays any attention until September. Very strange system we have. But why don't you just riff away at this particularly bizarre situation we have right now, where two hugely unpopular geriatrics are facing off, each one arguably demented in his own unique way. The floor is yours, David.
Sure. I mean, vis-a-vis the primary process itself, it's like if you were holding a baseball game and you did like batting practice and warm-ups and you got the pitchers ready to go out at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then you were like, all right, everybody, game's at 9. Okay, we'll see you in 7 hours. And it's like, wait, what? Wait, why don't we just like, why does it take 8 more months to do this? It's so crazy. But yeah, the primary processes that we have put in place have led us straight to this this total nightmare of an election. You know, Nikki Haley, who officially dropped out today without endorsing Trump, was seemingly never really in this thing at all. You know, I mean, she was the most serious competition that Trump had. She won one state plus DC in the whole time that she's been in the race. And got, you know, it's not like she came close in any of the other states, right? Like her second best performance last night was in Utah, where she only got beat by 15 points. So it's like, I don't know what to tell you. You know, the Republican primary voters, they heard the case from her and they were like, yeah, no thanks. And the thing that's particularly shocking about it is like, there's just poll after poll after poll. And, you know, I know we shouldn't be led around the noses by polls, right? It's just surveys. But, you know, these do have some meaning at this point. This poll after poll after poll shows Nikki Haley just like dusting Joe Biden like he's like a gnat on her sleeve, you know, like double digit margins. I think those margins would come down as the election approaches. But I do think that Nikki Haley would just like absolutely torch President Biden. And Republican primary voters looked at this reality, looked at the polls showing Haley blowing him out and Trump, you know, barely beating him. And they were like, we'll go with, you know, we'll go with the risky guy who's crazy,
yeah,
and try to overthrow the American system of government. Let's go with that guy. So I know what to tell you about Republican primary voters. Like these people are unreachable. You know, it's like you go out there. I don't know. You know, we talked for months about like, well, what kind of strategy could beat Trump in the primaries? And I said, you know, make the pragmatic case, you know, like he can't win or he's going to have a harder time winning than Haley does. And, you know, lo and behold, Haley went out, made that exact case. Maybe she was listening to the show. She started to do exactly that. She still got blown away. So I'm not sure that anybody could have beaten Trump.
Washington.
She did win Washington?
Yeah, that Washington, D.C.
Oh, D.C. Yeah. So she won Vermont and D.C. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to insult everyone's intelligence, Ben, but that's not enough. You know what I mean? You got to win more than that. You got to win... That seemed like, well, close to a majority of the contest if you want to be the nominee. That's just the way the rules are written. So, you know, she didn't get it done. I thought she, you know, look, man, I wouldn't vote for her if it was like the last day on earth. But like, I thought she ran a very good campaign, to be honest. I mean, she did everything she had to do. She did the retail politics. She crushed it in the debates. And the primary electorate in the Republican Party just didn't care. They're like, I know, we don't want you. Bye. And so they're going to get what they want, which is Donald Trump as the nominee. I'm not sure they're going to be happy with the outcome, but that's what they want. And here we go.
Well, you had this one line. It was a great riff. I urge everybody to check out the Newsweek column, Farris, F-A-R-I-S. Just Google Farris, you'll find it. You were talking about the contrast between Republican voters in a primary and Democratic voters in a primary. And it was so funny. It was like Democratic voters poring over the New York Times poll results to see which candidate is best positioned to win the election. And Republican voters just letting their freak flag fly. They love Trump. They're going with Trump, don't care about Trump, don't read the polls, just roll their eyes in disdain at the New York Times. Hey, did you see the interview, by the way? I'm going to talk about it in another interview with Marjorie Taylor Greene, with the British correspondent, is asking Marjorie Taylor Greene, she asked a pointed question about Jews?
Space lasers.
Space lasers, yeah. And Marjorie Taylor Greene just says, fuck off, and walks away. And I'm like, wow, that's how Republicans do it, man. That's just, they don't care. They just don't care. And they have good reason, because there's no consequence whatsoever for caring. Do you think it would work that way for Democrats if they just had that same attitude of indifference? Do you think it would work for it, or do you think they would be held accountable for what they do in a way Republicans aren't?
Well, this is the asymmetry in Washington, right? I mean, if a Democrat tried to do that, that would be the story for like 15 days, you know? Like there'd be like seven above the fold front page New York Times stories that were like, Biden told a reporter to F off, you know, boy, I don't know. What does this mean for Democrats? What does this mean for our democracy? Meanwhile, like Republicans are about to send a Senate nominee in Montana to a guy. He like assaulted a reporter on camera. Yeah. It's just unbelievable, you know? So it's like, yeah, there's, I mean, Democrats and Republicans are held to different rules at this point, because that's the end point of normalizing all of this like aberrant, like antisocial behavior that Trump has brought into the party. And all these like Trump wannabes acting like him, aping his mannerisms and his style of speech and turning themselves into like media stunt machines instead of legislators. That is now all just like taken for granted in DC. In the same way, like every time there's like a legislative standoff, it's like, you know, Congress to vote on whether to like blow up the planet with an asteroid. You know, and it's like every single Democrat voted to not be blown up by an asteroid. And the reports are like, Congress can't agree on whether Earth should be blown up by an asteroid. You know, Democrats and Republicans at a standstill. And it's like, no, they're not. It's actually not. It's like Democrats want to do the right thing, and Republicans are out here just like playing hardball politics against an opponent that just like rolls over for them over and over again. And that's just like, that is the taken for granted baseline of American politics right now. Right? It's like Republicans are crazy. Democrats are normal. If Democrats try to do anything to fight back procedurally or otherwise, right? That's the story for 10 days and not in a good way, right?
Wow, that's true. That is absolutely true. And it's why I say all the time, the New York Times in particular, you and I joke about it, we send texts about it and stuff like that, but it's absolutely worthless political coverage, in my humble opinion. It's just... They just bought in to what you just laid out in so way. I don't even know if they realize it. They're just so bought into this, and so yeah, they're great for financial coverage, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to know how capitalists are screwing each other, you really should read the New York Times. It's fascinating. One lawsuit after another as capitalists try to claw to make even more money than they already make. But political coverage, what a joke! All right, I don't know if we fully discussed the uncommitted results in Michigan. I'm pretty sure we didn't yesterday. We saw other examples of uncommitted. I get texts from some of my lefty friends after a primary vote on uncommitted, pounding chest in joy and exclamation. They're just really happy that the uncommitted did so well against Biden. I think it was 13% in Michigan. I forget what it was, 20% in Minnesota, something like that. I forget. In North Carolina, I think it was 13%. Any state that has the option of uncommitted, it is high. There's two questions. What do you make of the uncommitted vote? And then what do you make of the joy that lefties have at seeing the vulnerabilities of the person who's going to be leading them in the fight against fascism? I can't even get to where I understand Americans have, some Americans have a revulsion to what Israel's doing to Palestinians in Gaza. I completely understand that. But somehow the way that gets translated in the United States was like hatred toward Biden. When I don't know if you ever read the Republican takes on what's going on in the Middle East, David, it's like it makes Biden look like a pacifist. Okay. And so Democrats, it's like they've given up on beating Republicans. So they just take joy in defeating another Democrat. Your analysis of this.
I mean, there's two ways to look at this, right? One way is that the uncommitted vote in most of these states is like actually roughly comparable to what it was in 2012 for Obama in a percentage fashion, right? And that would suggest that like most of this is just a sort of standard issue dissatisfaction with that, with the nominee on the part of the, you know, the progressive faction of the party, or I don't want to call it the far left, right? That's pejorative, but like, you know what I mean, right? Like the faction of the coalition that's actually, that's a little bit harder to turn out. That's largely comprised of young people who like just haven't had the life experience to see third parties ruin your life over and over again. You know, they're more like intermittent voters. They're less likely to identify as Democrat, et cetera, et cetera. Right? And so this wing of the party has registered its dissatisfaction with incumbent Democratic presidents over and over again, right? So this is not new. What's new is that the raw totals are a lot higher than in 2012, right? So like turnout is higher. And that means like there are just like more people who are more dissatisfied with the Biden administration in a more focused way. If you go back and you look at the 2012 uncommitted vote, and you're like, why are they doing this? You would get like 15 different answers, right? It was like, Tim Geithner and the bailout. It'd be like, you know, it didn't help the people with the housing. It was like some Occupy Wall Street stuff, maybe. Was that happening in 2012? But like, you know, you would have gotten a variety of answers, right? Like, we didn't like the troop surge in Afghanistan, or, you know, we didn't like some of the things Obama did. We wanted the public option in the ACA, right? There was like a lot of things that the progressive left was upset with Obama about that were being expressed in those uncommitted votes, right? These uncommitted votes are about like one thing. You know, these uncommitted votes are about Gaza, and it is an organized campaign as opposed to a disorganized campaign. Like the campaign has a leadership as opposed to being like sort of leaderless. And in that sense, like, it's a warning to Biden, but it is also like the easiest thing in the world to respond to, because people are saying like, we want to see something different from you on Gaza. So, like, I mean, maybe some people expect him to like, I don't know, like wade into Rafah and be like, everybody stop, you know, my dad said, Joey, you know, no more killing. But I think like most reasonable people just want him to support a ceasefire now, right? Like do something. You know, I think it's not going to be cutting the aid, right? But like go out in public, argue for a cease, for an immediate ceasefire, act like you care about Palestinian civilians. Let people see that, right? Like have a public rift with Netanyahu, like stop with the whole like Biden aides quietly furious with Netanyahu stuff, and go out in public and be furious with him on behalf of the civilians who are being brutalized in this campaign. That's what people want. Okay. And so like, to me, the uncommitted vote is in its own way a kind of a gift to the Biden campaign, because it's like, it's people saying like, hey, there's a lot of us here in Minnesota and Michigan that are really unhappy with your Gaza policy. If the election is close, this could be the difference. Like, do you want to win or lose? And I think a lot of those people are gettable with a, you know, fairly simple policy shift on Gaza. But if, you know, if Biden is still out there in September just writing blank checks to Israel, and we've got 50, 100,000 dead Palestinians, man, we've got a real problem on our hands. And the reason that we have a real problem on our hands is not just that Biden is polling badly against Trump, it's that it gets worse when you include the third party candidates. Okay. And we haven't talked about this yet, but for whatever reason that is completely unfathomable to me, getting like 15% of the electorate is saying they're going to vote for Bobby Kennedy Jr., who's a total nutcase. Yeah. But he's got that magic God's gift of a last name, and he's going to ride it all the way to September. He might get into the debates if we have debates, right? Like the Commission on Presidential Debates sets a threshold of 15%.
Yeah.
In polling, and you have to be on the ballot in enough states to win the Electoral College. He's probably going to get there.
Yeah.
You know, if he's polling, he's going to be up there. God help us all.
Yeah.
If we have to watch a debate between Joe Biden, Donald Trump, and Bobby Kennedy Jr., and those are our options in September, like that's just going to be a real demoralizing moment. But we're at real risk of losing votes to third parties. I mean, Kennedy is actually not to the left of Biden on Gaza, but he could be. He doesn't really seem to have any principles. So he could look at a poll and be like, seems like the path to victory is to support the Palestinians. Like, let's do that, gang.
Well, that would be Kennedy. Just so you know, that would be this. As probably the only guy in America who studies politicians' position on Israel and Gaza, you know, this, I could tell you that Bobby Kennedy right now is, if you view this, to the right of Biden on Gaza.
Yeah, exactly.
So any lefty who votes for Kennedy on the principle that they don't like the slaughter of Palestinians by Israelis is diluted. And that's a reality. So yeah, you're perfectly correct when you say Bobby Kennedy has no principles and could flip if he thought it would bring him votes. But that's where he stands right now. Just for the record. But that was an excellent analysis. You're absolutely correct. And I know the weird thing about me, David, is if I given the choice, I would have voted uncommitted. Mm-hmm. If I had that choice, I would have voted uncommitted because I don't like Biden's policy toward Gaza. I don't like the blank checks. I don't like the hugging of Netanyahu. But I wouldn't pound my chest about it. You know, oh, yeah. Right, right. Well, yeah. No, I don't think so. It's like there's a weird attitude that lefties have where they hate the Democrats who they're supposedly in alliance with more than they hate MAGA. I've noticed this now since 2016. Well, I've noticed this my whole life, actually, because I've lived among the lefties my whole life. And they hate what they know, you know, and they just despise Dems. We'll get into California in a little while, but that's, it's a reality. So, yeah, I get these exclamations of joy and jubilation at every poll that shows Biden down from my lefties. Like, yeah, all right. Guys, you realize what's on the horizon, don't you? Fascism.
Yeah. It's like there's a lot of young people that don't remember 2016, Ben. I mean, the people that are voting for the first time were 10.
Yeah, okay. You know what I understand mean? That, so, but I'm talking about people who are in their 60s. All right. So they remember. All right. They remember. They go. No excuse for them. All right. This is a subject that I could talk about forever, but we're going to condense it to one part of a larger conversation. And that is the Supreme Court Colorado ruling, which I'm utterly obsessed with and we'll be doing full shows on. I got one tomorrow that I cannot wait to do with someone who we've been sharing articles about, a deep dive analysis of it. But you said something in passing about Bobby Kennedy. And this brought home one of the just really absurd aspects of the Colorado ruling. Of course, the Colorado ruling, everybody out there knows what it is. But just in case there's the one person who doesn't, the Supremes in their infinite wisdom ruled that Colorado could not kick Donald Trump off the ballot for being an insurrectionist without even discussing whether he was an insurrectionist or not, which is the most germane point of the whole issue. They left that aside. They said it would be chaotic. If each individual state got to determine which federal candidate was on its ballot. Utterly absurd to anybody who's paid any attention to what happens in Illinois and other states all the time with ballot access issues in terms of signatures. And you mentioned in passing Bobby Kennedy. He may be in the debates. It's not clear if Bobby Kennedy will be on ballots in certain states. Why? Because you can challenge Bobby Kennedy in any state you want to. He's running for a federal office. He's a presidential candidate. It's state by state. Nobody has sued on the constitutional issue of whether Illinois could kick Bobby Kennedy off the ballot because it's an absurd issue. And it's, by the way, it flip-flops because first it was Dems trying to kick him off the ballot because they thought him as a threat to Biden. And then once he was running as an independent, suddenly Republicans are talking about kicking him off the ballot because, David, I think he's actually more of a threat to Donald Trump. I would love your thoughts on the Colorado ruling. Whatever point you want to articulate that pops to your mind, maybe you want to defend it. Whatever. The floor is yours. Your thoughts on the Colorado ruling.
Oh, man, the floor is yours. My favorite words in the English language. All right, so look, I came on the show repeatedly and I said, maybe they'll vote against Trump. You know, I mean, who knows? That was wrong. Okay, so I have to cop up to that immediately. In a broader sense, of course, the ruling is absurd. I mean, one of the reasons that we got this ruling, though, is just it's like a pervasive problem with the American Constitution, which is that it is underspecified. Even the amendments are underspecified, okay? So if you go to the 14th Amendment, I think the language of the 14th Amendment like very clearly bars Trump from office. The problem is it doesn't say who should bar him from office. You know what I mean? It's just said, like, if you've been found to engage in insurrection, you're ineligible for to run for office. And it's like, well, who makes that determination? You know? And so I just want to take a step back in a broader sense here and look at the whole arc of the post-election plot and the insurrection and the impeachment and the acquittal and the trials and this and the Colorado ruling stuff. Like, this is what has happened, okay? When Trump was in office, right, we were told you can't be prosecuted while you're in office. The president has immunity. The only way to do it is to go through the impeachment process, okay? So we went through the impeachment process twice, right? The second time around, Republicans in the Senate looked at the impeachment process and they were like, well, I mean, the president's already left office, so we can't convict him and then bar him from holding future office, right? So we got to throw it to the courts, right? And then they threw it to the courts, and Merrick Garland stalled for a year before finally greenlighting an investigation of it. And now we're being told that the Supreme Court is considering whether Donald Trump has total immunity while he's in office. Like, that's now actually being considered by the Supreme Court of the United States, right? The president has total immunity, do whatever he wants in office. Okay, so it's like, okay, we were told impeach and convict, can't do that. We were told go after him in the courts, can't do that. So who or what is supposed to enforce the provisions of the 14th Amendment if you can't hold, if you can't prosecute the guy in the space of a single presidential administration to prevent him from getting back into office? Well, then how can you blame the states for trying to enforce the 14th Amendment when no one else seems to want to do it? Okay, so I understand, right? I understand that there are holes in the Colorado case, and I'm not a Supreme Court watcher, and I do not have any degrees in constitutional law, right? But I've read some smart people that don't think that the case, you know, don't think the plaintiffs did a very good job. Fine, whatever, right? I think the broader point is that what our political system is showing us and what the Supreme Court has enlisted itself in is a project that makes presidents completely above the law. Like, not just like in a rhetorical sense, but like there are people that have looked at these, like the immunity case that's going to come before the case now that's holding up the J6 trial. People are like, oh, if he wins this case, Biden could just assassinate him, right? I mean, what would, like, if the president has total immunity from crimes committed in office, what is to stop Joe Biden from just like rolling a division of the army up to Mar-a-Lago and blowing it up, right? If you have total immunity, it's like, okay, yes, of course that's unconstitutional. You can't like execute an American citizen in America, right? But you also can't overthrow the American government in America, right? And Trump did just that. He did it in broad daylight, didn't hide it, right? Has not denied anything that he did. And yet, like institution after institution after institution after institution after institution in the United States has failed to hold this guy accountable for what he did, right? And so you look at the situation as like, okay, well, there is actually no way to hold him responsible for what happened on January 6th and in the days preceding January 6th and then the days after January 6th. Okay. And if that's the case, I just don't know what to tell you. You know, like, then we live in a completely lawless system where the president can order assassinations and hits on people, like, and just like be a gangster. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
I think that's preposterous. And I hope that the Supreme Court rejects the immunity argument, right? But like the very fact that they are considering it is extremely disturbing, right? And so I look at the Colorado stuff and I'm like, okay, you know, that was worth a shot, right? Because again, because the Constitution doesn't specify who should enforce the insurrection language in the 14th Amendment, why not us, right? Like, why not do it at the state level? Because the states do have the power to conduct the elections as they see fit according to the Constitution, unless Congress says otherwise. So I don't know, Ben. It's just wow, really, it's just demoralizing.
That was a great riff. And I tell you what, I just saw a movie which I urge everybody to watch if you can. It's only on one screen in the Chicagoland area, and I think it closes at the end of this week. So by the time you hear this, you won't be able to watch it. But if it's streaming, watch it. It's an animated documentary called They Shot the Piano Player. And it's about Toriano, who is a great Brazilian jazz musician who disappeared in Argentina in 1976. And this gets to the point you're making. When the CIA backed the military dictatorships in South America, and they were able to do what you just said, to sweep people off the street, take them to
dungeons and prisons, torture them, and then murder them. And then they dump their bodies into rivers. Thousands and thousands of people disappeared. It's really horrific and horrible. And what you just described is what I've been afraid of. I feel it's like more and more of the people in our country, we laugh at it, that's the darkness of the comedy, are dedicated to fascism. They want fascism. I don't know what else to say. They want fascism, and then the people who are supposed to be fighting fascism seem to be delighted that the fascists will win because that will somehow or other prove they were right in this their little internal argument with their own allies.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is what I'm actually really genuinely scared by this. And I should send you this. I don't usually send you the, I write some culture pieces for the week now. There's a novel that won the Man Booker Prize last year called Prophet Song. And it's set in Ireland, but it is very applicable to the United States. And it's from the perspective of a single family that's being like, there's a new fascist party that comes to power in Ireland, you know, via the ballot. Right. And they create a new like KGB to go after people. And the novel is from the perspective of this one family, this woman whose husband is like leads the teachers union, and he's disappeared by the Irish KGB. And the rest of the novel is just her like navigating the world in which that happened, including a civil war that comes to her block. And I found the novel really chilling, right? Because if you look at what's happening with Trump, what he's saying in public, what the courts are saying about what he can and can't do, I'm like, what is to stop him from winning the election in November, you know, issuing an executive order to create like a new agency inside the federal government and just doing exactly what you just said, right? Like ordering hits on like journalists and opposition figures and disappearing them and dropping them out of helicopters. Who or what is going to stop him from doing that? I mean, it's a serious question. I mean, who's going to stop him, right? He's got the 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court and get whatever he wants. And you know, the court, I'm still get sued. Right. And then the courts will be like, well, I mean, he's in office, right? You can't hold him accountable for that. And so all he needs to do is put people into the right positions who are willing to carry out those orders, and he can do whatever he wants. And so to my uncommitted friends in Michigan, I actually respect the effort that they did here. I think in some ways it's quite smart to try to send a message shot across the bow. But at the end of the day, you got to be willing to come back and vote for Biden, whether it works or it doesn't work. You know, I know that's painful because the Biden administration's Gaza policies are awful and indefensible and make me burn with anger. But I still don't want to live in like a fascist dictatorship because of it. Okay. So it's like you have to weigh the needs of the few and the needs of the many here, you know, and it's like, if things haven't changed by September, I understand why that's so frustrating and wrong. But it's not going to help anybody in Gaza to plunge America into a fascist nightmare. It's going to make it worse for Gaza, and you're going to have to live in a fascist dictatorship for the rest of your life. So those are the stakes. I don't know how to articulate those stakes in a way that will reach people who are wavering right now. I don't think shaming them works. Didn't seem to work in 2016, right? We're like, you idiot, how could you consider doing this? It's like, I don't know, man. You have to have like one-to-one conversations with people that you trust, right? Like those voters have to be talked to one by one by friends and family members, not like robocalls from Joe Biden, not like desperate text messages, you know? David, have you seen? David, help me, everything's ending. That's not going to move the needle. You know, people look at those text messages and they're like, man, give me a break. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I get like random like candidates for Congress just texting me like, David, all is lost. All is lost. No, and it's like,
I get those.
This is the end. This is the end, David. It's Joe Biden. This is the end. I'm like, are you killing yourself? Are you committing suicide in this text message? Like, what's going on, man? So,
oh my God.
But no, I mean, I know people who are wavering, right? And so the only thing I can do, I mean, I could write my op-eds, right? But like, nobody who's going to vote against Joe Biden in November because of Gaza is going to read one of my op-eds and be like, you know what? Actually, that Ferris is right. You know, it has to be people they know and trust. Honestly, it really does. Yeah. Right. So if you know wavering people, it's your job to go talk them out of this. You know, that's what you can do. That's how you can contribute to avoiding the apocalypse here. is do some old style organizing.
Yeah.
Reach out to your friends. Maybe we should organize one of those like vote trade systems that we had in 2000. Remember this?
Yeah.
Later, where like I didn't actually do it, but I remember thinking, I lived in New Jersey at the time, and I was like, all right, I mean, I'll vote for Gore I'll vote for Nader for somebody in Florida, and we can swap, right? Like, sure. I mean, we need to get creative here, because I actually think that the third parties are going to be a real sticking point here this year. That's just the feeling that I have about it. It feels very similar to 2000, except worse, because there's more of them. There's like a Perot in the race, in addition to a Nader and whatever nutcase the libertarians are going to run. So I'm really worried about all this. And honestly, I'm like really, really worried.
Well, the other element of your analysis that I have not asked you about, and I have not asked any guests about, and I've thought about it too. Here's my opportunity to do it. So you're contrasting the percentage of uncommitted votes that Michigan voters cast against Biden as opposed to Michigan voters against Barack Obama. And you point out that as a percentage, they're roughly the same, maybe a percentage higher. But, the difference is the turnout's higher. And I'm like, well, that's an interesting development that I've not seen anyone analyze anywhere. And I've now thought of, like, why is the turnout higher? We do, there's nobody running of consequence by name in the Democratic primary, okay? We joke that Marianne Williamson and I haven't completely for Dean Phillips, okay? I got that one. So the reality, they get, if you combine them together, they get like 4% of the vote, something like that. So there's no one of consequence running. There's no one even remotely of like Nikki Haley running. And yet turnout is higher, which means something's at play here, David, that has not been explained. So why don't you try to explain it? Why is turnout higher in 2024 than it was in 2012?
Sure. Dean and Marianne, first of all, sounds like a 60s folk duo, you know? It's like they'll sing some Joni Mitchell songs, whatever. I think there's a fairly simple explanation here, right? Which is like, because there's been an organized pushback uncommitted campaign, there is a counter mobilization among Biden supporters, right? So I think like without the uncommitted stuff, I think that Biden and his team would have been content to just like sit back and not do anything in these primaries, right? Because like, again, as you noted, there's nobody credible challenging him. Right, there's a 0.0% chance of anybody arriving in Chicago in August with a majority other than Joe Biden. Right, that's just the way the process is playing out. That's the way the process is always going to play out, because he didn't draw a challenger who could win. But I think that when Michigan Dems in particular, Michigan activists in particular, started organizing this uncommitted vote to send a message to the Biden campaign, it spurred. It's not like Biden is going to Michigan to campaign, right? But there's also an organized effort on behalf of the Biden administration to try to get people to the polls, right? And they did it in New Hampshire too. Remember, like they changed the calendar to put South Carolina first, but they couldn't actually force New Hampshire to move theirs because they don't control the state legislature. So New Hampshire was like, we're going to do it anyway. The DNC was like, fine, you get no delegates. And I think initially the Biden team was like, well, let's just like let whatever happens. We don't care because we're standing on principle here. And then they looked at Dean Phillips and they were like, oh God, like what if Dean Phillips like wins this like fake New Hampshire primary and then becomes a credible threat? I mean, Dean Phillips is not like a crazy person, right? I mean, he's a member of Congress. He seems normal. If you go and listen to him, like, I don't like him, but he's not like, Lyndon LaRouche. You know what I mean? If he could get a platform, if anybody could hear what he had to say, he might have dug into Biden's numbers a little bit more. So they didn't want that to happen. So they actually organized a write-in campaign in New Hampshire for Biden, who was not on the ballot. And the president's team was like, actually, we can't just let this go. Let's do the write-in and let's win. And let's win, right? Like they don't want anything getting in the way of his ascension to the nomination again. So to me, it's a straightforward, like, once the opposition bloc, the uncommitted bloc, got organized and started kind of whipping votes, as it were, I think the Biden campaign also started whipping votes, and the outcome is substantially higher turnout, and it's all driven by Gaza.
Well, I do believe
that it's time the United States, to put it mildly, reassess its attitude, put it mildly, about Israel and Palestinians in the Middle East. Absolutely. And so if that results, good. If that's the result of all this. But I'll point out, like I always do on every single issue, there are two parties in America. And just take a look at the quote-unquote debate that exists in this country on something like climate change, where the Republican Party's attitude is it's a hoax and there's nothing we need to do about it. As the clock, as we go through like February's where it's 70 degrees, okay, what I'm saying, David? And Democrats are just fooling themselves if they think they could bring about substantive change on any issue in our country by ignoring the fact that the Republican Party is just resistant to any kind of deal, to any kind of compromise, to even recognizing it as a problem. And we're going to see that in Gaza. I see it, David, because I get access to the emails they send, you know, the fundraising pitches, which they're already striking up a chorus that somehow or other Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are anti-Semitic. And so it's unbelievable. It's shameless, but I mean, what do you expect? It's MAGA. We just started talking. We started about Marjorie Taylor Greene already.
It's with the third party stuff. In 2016, before I got the gig at The Week and these other gigs, I used to write for this website called Informed Comment, which is a Middle East focused blog that was started around the Iraq War. And I wrote an article for them before the election that was called Vote for Hillary Clinton or Die in a Fiery Apocalypse. And it was a letter to young people to try to explain why third parties can't win in America. You know, I'll send it to you. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. But it's got like an elaborate explanation of the electoral system and why third parties don't do well and like why the ones that we have are actually like weird and extreme and not appealing to people anyway. But I think I'm gonna just dust that off and update it and publish it somewhere again, because it's just like history's just repeating itself. Like I'm having the same arguments with people I had in 2016. It's just, you know, every 8 years we just seem to have this like, we have this need to put out the third party fires. And you know, you can put some of the blame on that for Democrats, honestly, but at the end of the day, there's two choices, right? It's like you go to a restaurant with two items on the menu, and you're like, I don't like either of these things, you know, why don't you make me something that doesn't exist? And that's the basic dynamic here, right? It's like, you can't conjure that thing into being because it's not there.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you from my experience, there's just going to be a certain percentage of folks who are on the left who are not going to buy you, which you're selling on this position at all, and will never participate. They didn't vote for Obama. They didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. They didn't vote for Al Gore. I know them. Many of them are my family. And that's just the reality. So shame, as you said, shame doesn't work with anyone under the age of, let's say, 30. It just will never work. You can't shame a young person. Shame may work with people over the age of 60. Particularly if it's a younger person shaming them. And then they're like, oh, I want to be hip like this youngster. So, all right. Exposing the idiocy of Democrats to a certain degree, let's talk California. Not talked about this with you yet, and I'm just curious what your thoughts on this are. So there was a Democrat, follow me in this, ladies and gentlemen, there was a Senate primary in California yesterday to fill out the seat created, the vacancy created when Dianne Feinstein died, okay, to fill out her term. Anyway, the way they have the system in California, everybody runs in one election, no matter what your political party is. And the two top vote getters, if no one gets over 50%, meet off. All right. The two top vote getters are a congressman named Adam Schiff, who is a Democrat, and a former baseball player that Chicago Cubs fans despise named Steve Garvey. He used to play for the Dodgers, and he played for the Padres. Nothing more need be said about why Cubs fans hate him so much. Just go back and look at 1984. The point is, Garvey is a Republican. The Democrats, in what I believe is their idiocy, promoted Garvey's campaign on the grounds that he would ultimately be easier to defeat, the shift Democrats, I should say, on the grounds that he would be easier to defeat than Barbara Lee or Katie Porter, most likely Katie Porter. This is a continuation of strategy we saw in 2022, David, where Democrats promote fascists because they think they're easy to beat. I didn't like it in 2022. I really don't like it now. Can Garvey win? Can he beat Adam Schiff? Well, if enough Democrats sit it out because they don't like Schiff's attitude on Gaza, yes. So it's the dumbest strategy, in my opinion, to coddle fascists as opposed to opposing fascists. That's my opinion. Love to hear your thoughts on this, David. Go ahead.
Okay, so I don't even know where to start with this one. I hate California's primary system. Okay, I really dislike it intensely. You know, we used to call it a jungle primary system. And it is, in a few races over the years, it has led to like Democrats being shut out of a race, right, where there's like two Republicans at the top of the ticket. The last couple of Senate races in California have been Democrat against Democrat, which is like fine, I guess. But, you know, even if Republicans are 40% of California, like, should they not have an option in November? You know what I mean? Like, that's a little bit crazy, too. So the whole system is just ridiculous, right? Like, it's a dumb reform. It hasn't achieved anything that they thought it would achieve in terms of like encouraging moderation, et cetera, et cetera. And they really should walk that whole thing back, and then we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I come at this from a position of like not really liking Adam Schiff very much. So that informs my whole analysis of this. If I lived in California, I would have voted for Katie Porter. I think she's a interesting kind of, you know, younger voice, progressive. Apparently she's like a bad boss or something. So I don't know. Right. I didn't follow it that closely, but the point is that like Schiff deliberately boosted Garvey.
Yeah.
Because he thought that Porter would give him a real race in November, which, judging from these results, I don't even know if that's true, right? Like, I don't know that this would ever have been competitive. If Schiff just has this like incredible name ID, you know, he was like the leader of the resistance libs during the Ukraine thing. And that's how he made his name. And Californians are like, yeah, sure, that guy. that's a mystery to me. I don't understand. California Democrats have not made the choice that I would like them to make, like again and again here. So it just continues a pattern. From a pure, like, just hardball politics standpoint, if you're Adam Schiff and you want to become the next U.S. Senator from California, this made total sense. You know, if you have internal polling that shows you in a tight race against Porter, of course you're going to boost Garvey because, like, I don't think there's any chance that Garvey wins this race. You know, I mean, a Republican hasn't won anything in California since like Schwarzenegger, right? I mean, it's been so long since a Republican won a statewide race in the state of California that I'm not even sure it's possible anymore. And like, famous baseball player or not, I mean, I'm sorry, the era that Steve Garvey is from is just not going to resonate with a lot of today's voters. You know, like the 1980s are a long time ago. And baseball is a long time ago. You know, I love baseball. You love baseball. But my friends, it is not America's most popular sport. So, from a pure sort of like cutthroat politics standpoint, Schiff did what he had to do to get the nomination. And I think he'll beat Garvey handily. I think from a strategic, you know, like from a, what would be the best thing for Democrats as a party? I think we would all have benefited from a Schiff-Porter race in the sense of like, you know, the moderates versus the progressives. We'd have some policy arguments, and we're not going to get that. At the end of the day, I'm going to come down and say, I don't actually think this is that big of a deal. I think that this is largely the responsibility of the like preposterous primary system that Californians have. If they had a normal primary system where the two parties were separated in a different elections, then we would have gotten this moderate progressive debate as part of that primary. Mm-hmm. And then voters would go with who they thought was best. And that never really happened because when Garvey entered the race, then it became about like, well, who's boosting Garvey to help who? And then they're complaining about that. And that's the conversation they're having rather than like policy. What I want, the only thing I want to know, one thing from the senator from California, next senator from California. Will you vote to eliminate the filibuster? Yes or no? That is literally all I care about from that person. Because if we get another Feinstein in the Senate who's like, boy, it would be too disruptive to torch the filibuster. That's not how we did it in the 60s with my buddy Strom Thurmond. You know, like, if we get one more of these people in the Senate, I am going to stroke out. You know what I mean? So, Adam Schiff, if you're listening, please vote to eliminate the filibuster. Okay, that's all I care about. Good luck.
By the way, you'll be singing a different song about the filibuster if Trump is victorious, Republicans take back the Senate, and they hold on to Congress. You will be singing it. I love tradition.
I will be Mr. Filibuster. Yeah, you know? I'll dress up as a filibuster.
But do it legit, man, like Jimmy Stewart. Do it legit. Don't do like the wimpy filibuster. To me, it's like I'm old school with filibusters. Get on the floor. Just start talking.
Hold
like
the floor.
Wendy Davis in Texas. Do it. Yeah. Like old school.
Catheterize yourself so you don't have to go to the bathroom. You know?
Who did that? Somebody did that. I forget. Yes. Which, so like, that is committed.
It's commitment. Yeah.
All right. Let's close with. I can't even get this out of my mouth. One of your favorite top topics, Senator Sinema of Arizona, for show after show repeatedly, I forget what year, I think 2022, David would do these fantastic riffs on Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin, Sinema of Arizona, Manchin of West Virginia, and how they were in his nightmares just because of what you just got finished saying. They were committed to the filibuster, preserving the traditions of the Senate, even if it meant fascism was advancing in this country. Well, she announced, I think it was yesterday, that she was not going to run for re-election. Joe Manchin has already announced he is not going to run for re-election. So one could argue that David Ferris has been victorious in these two arenas. So reflections on the legacy of Kyrsten Sinema. Go ahead, David.
Na 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 na. Speaking na, of na, na, yeah. Goodbye, Kyrsten. I mean, like, in a political sense, like, Kyrsten Sinema's career arc was like, she was like a lefty back in the day, and then she got elected to the Senate as a moderate, and then what she did was immediately, like, in a political sense, like, pour gasoline on herself and set herself on fire. I mean, I've never seen, in all of my years of following politics, I have never seen a member of the U.S. Senate just like destroy their own career for absolutely no reason than Kyrsten Sinema. You know, like, this is a person, it's like, look, Americans love bipartisan stuff, right? Like, if you're out there being like, let's sign deals about immigration, you're not going to get fired for that. Okay. And in most places, what Sinema did was like, she managed to alienate everyone on both sides of the aisle, like, so quickly that her career has been over since like mid-2021. You know, she's just been a dead woman walking politically. And the principles that she stood on to end her own career were things like, no, like, the government should not be allowed to negotiate drug prices with Medicare. You know, like, she deliberately went after specific policies that were important to Democrats, and she destroyed them. She became the face of the filibuster, you know, which is like a total mystery to me why you would want to do that. And in the process, like, made herself just completely uncompetitive in a Democratic primary while still voting for just enough things to make Republicans hate her too, right? And so suddenly you simply have no path to victory. This has been clear since like the very first poll that came out in like 2021. Of like, you know, Ruben Gallego versus Sinema, and then a three-way race. All of these polls have showed that Gallego would wipe the floor with her in a primary, and that she's barely cracking double digits in a three-way general election. And so we've all just been like waiting around for her to face reality on this. And the only thing I will say is, like, to her credit, is that getting out, I think, does help Gallego. You know, in other words, like, Carrie Lake is going to be the Republican nominee in this race, which is deranged that Republicans are doing this again. Just another case of like the Republican primary electorate, like, unreachable, cannot learn, right? Let's do Carrie Lake again. Like, I'm sure Blake Masters isn't far behind. So, you know, this is a fitting end to her career, right? Just like a humiliation She bows out. She wasted all 6 of her years in the Senate, just like halting progress. And she will be remembered very poorly, I think, by everyone. I don't know what she's going to do next. A lobbyist. Maybe she'll take the no labels presidential bid, and then usher in the fascist dictatorship for us. But I've been saying for years, like, Manchin and Sinema did like incalculable damage to the Biden administration. By keeping the filibuster in place, it's like we couldn't do anything about Dobbs, couldn't do anything about voting rights. Like the agenda got cut in half. We ain't getting paid family leave, any of this stuff. Like things that personally were very personally important to me, like things that were destroyed that could have helped me personally were destroyed by Kyrsten Sinema, and so I hate her. in a broader sense, you know, there is still a big difference between Manchin and Sinema. In that, like, somebody said on Twitter, it was really funny, because I think it was Dylan Byers. He was like, look, the way to look at it is, like, every vote that you got from Joe Manchin was, like, an irreplaceable gift from God. You know, like, look, he's literally the only person that could have held that seat in West Virginia. In Arizona, it's like, any Democrat could win that seat, right? And so she's really standing in the way in progress. In the way it's like, Manchin, it's like, as long as he was in the Senate and giving us occasional votes, it was like, I guess that's better than the alternative of a Republican in West Virginia. I really don't like Joe Manchin. Okay, so don't get me wrong. But Sinema was like just replacement, you know, like easily replaceable, and she will be replaced. I think that she will beat Carrie Lake. I think Gallego will beat Carrie Lake, and that'll be the end for Kyrsten Sinema. So yeah, yesterday was a really happy day for me. I saw the headlines and I just got an extra boost in my step, you know. It's like, bye, Kyrsten. Yeah, thank you for finally facing reality.
And for the record, David Ferris's nightmare in 2020 did not even involve Kyrsten Sinema. I don't think she had emerged as the particular challenge, to put it euphemistically, that she had became. It was all about Joe Manchin. I remember many conversations where you would say, I had a nightmare where he needed Joe Manchin's phone. It came down to Joe Manchin. Howling at the moon at late at night. I can't sleep at Joe Manchin. You got to laugh to keep from crying. All right, David, we'll close it down right now. We've covered all our topics. And at least we are laughing at the moment. Fascism has not become like in the Prophet Song, I believe is the name of the book, which I will now immediately order from the library. And read, because it sounds very intriguing, although why I should read it.
It's not a pick-me-up, okay? I just got to warn you.
Yeah, no, it's not a pick-me-up. And neither is ultimately They Shot the Piano Player, though I urge everybody to check it out, because, yes, there's this horrific telling of Operation Condor, which is what the name of the campaign to kill, give ultimate power to the military police. But at least that movie is beautiful to watch. The colors are excellent, and the music is fantastic. Brazilian jazz. So, there's a little sweetness to that movie as well. All right, David, a pleasure talking to you. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, all right?
Likewise, Ben. Take care, and we'll check back in soon. I'm sure lots of great things will happen in the interim.
Lots of great things in the next 2 weeks, yes. He's David Ferris. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.